All right, my name is Ted Mansfield, and I am a doctoral candidate at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health. A little bit of my background that sort of motivates my work. I think it provides a nice context. I have a background in civil engineering, and then I studied city and regional planning at UNC, and now I'm in the School of Public Health, finishing up my PhD. So I sometimes approach transportation from a health perspective, and sometimes I approach health within transportation. So this presentation is really me putting my public health hat on and thinking about transportation from a health perspective, a more traditional health perspective. No relationships to disclose. So transportation and health, there's a lot of pathways through which these two things interact. And I'm really focusing here on air pollution, physical activity, and crashes, although we know there's a lot of other health pathways, mental health and stress and all those things are also affected, but I'm not focusing on those. And the interesting thing about some of these risks is that within urban environments, they can sort of compete. So we know that walkable neighborhoods support increased walking. When you have dense land uses, diverse land use mix, urban environments that support walking, people walk more. However, these neighborhoods are also sometimes more likely to have higher air pollution levels, just because of where they sort of are in cities. There's been a couple studies that look at that relationship. So this becomes interesting when you look at subpopulations of travelers. So there's an interesting study from looking in London of their bike share program that sort of modeled the health impacts of individuals who switched their transportation mode to cycling for certain trips. And the benefits for individuals are very high in that the physical activity benefits outweigh the risks from other associated health pathways. However, looking at sort of at the population level, even with the most pristine walkable urban environments, there's still some sort of level of individual preference that's going to dictate behaviors that occur. So we're not necessarily going to get, close to 100% mode share of walking and biking for work. So some of these physical activity benefits can, in some sense, be diluted when you're thinking about this at the population scale and thinking about like neighborhood level interventions through a health lens. So a little motivating context here on just these transportation health risks I mentioned. This is from the 2013 Global Burden of Disease Report from the University of Washington Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. And here are those three transportation risks I highlighted. And these are the top 14 health risks in the United States. So we see that these three risks combine to approximately 10% of the burden of mortality in the United States estimated in 2013. We know that transportation is not entirely responsible for low physical activity levels, but it does contribute to that risk. So I think it's a nice motivating factor for really thinking about these risks in a little bit more substantial way. So that leads to my objective, which is how do transportation health risks vary vary across different neighborhood types? And to think about that question, I have three objectives that I seek to answer in this particular research project, which is first to develop a novel dynamic model to assess the health risk associated with transportation, and then to use this model to compare transportation health risks first at the population level and then look at subpopulations. At this stage, just by commuting behavior, in future iterations, I will also look at vulnerable populations in this lens. So jumping right ahead, I have quite a few slides. I'm kind of going quickly. I'm going to jump right into my methods. I'll first talk about the model I'm using and then introduce the case study location in which I apply the model, then talk about data because data is a big issue with these types of models. So I use an approach called Markov chain modeling, which in its most general sense is a way to look at the distribution of states in some system over time. So conceptually what we do is we divide the world, the population that we're looking at, into these states. In this example, state E and state A. And these states are linked by transition probabilities. So in this simple example, the transition probability from state A, you have a 40% chance of going to E or a 60% chance of staying in A, and the same sort of thing for state E. And then the model sort of looks at discrete time steps and advances over time by looking at the distribution of the population within these states as well as these transition probabilities. So this model, this general model has been used in many fields, telecommunications networks, lots of applications. And there is some work looking at health impact assessment. This is a model from the Netherlands. It's a great acronym to Dynamo HIA, a dynamic model for health impact assessment. It's a very powerful tool that also uses this approach. So thinking about this specifically for health, here's sort of an example of a general health impact model that uses a Markov chain approach. So over here on the left side, we have a healthy population state and two intermediate disease states, and then finally mortality states there on the right side. And they're all linked by these transition probabilities that are defined by underlying health data. As we look at the model over time, we see these transitions occurring, and we see transitions from the healthy population to the disease states as well as to mortality to some endpoint. This is looking at sort of one cohort advancing through some period of time. So that's a general case. And this is the model that I am applying in the case study location. So I take that same sort of model structure, and then I have five intermediate diseases here. So type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, sort of as a general group, and then three types of cancers, lung, colon, and breast cancer. And then I also have a disease-specific and all other cause mortality that's taken from ICD death data. So then I link these all to these other transition states, and transition probabilities are defined by health data such as the incidence functions and underlying mortality rates in the population. And then finally, this model is run as a baseline simulation, and then for each risk, we run this model in tandem and look at the difference between the populations over time to come back and estimate health impacts associated with these risks that we consider. So moving on to the case study location, this is the Research Triangle area in North Carolina, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. It makes a triangle, that's the name. And we looked at a single neighborhood in this region. It's a suburban neighborhood outside of downtown Raleigh. It has a fairly low population density. It's not very walkable. In many ways, it's representative of a lot of neighborhoods in the United States, especially in the Southeast. And it's the Blue Ridge Road Corridor, the BRRC. And it's a neighborhood with about 11,500 people. There is a slightly larger share of individuals between 18 and 35, which will have some meaning later on in the presentation. I'll talk back on this point. And here's the age distribution of the census block group populations for both males and females in the case study location. So talking about data, I mentioned these are very data-intensive models. So when you have these Markov chain models that are defined by these probability transitions over time, you need to have age and sex-specific data for both your population parameters and your disease parameters, so prevalence, which is the sort of percentage of disease in the population at a given time, as well as incidence, which is the rate at which individuals may become diseased over time. So I used a variety of sources here to collect all this data, some state-level sources, the census, and then I had to model disease incidence using a tool from the World Health Organization called DISMOD, which is a pretty nice little tool for any epidemiology like nerds out there. So now talking about the last sort of component of this model, which is exposure. So here's our input data for PM2.5 air pollution in the case study neighborhood. This is from a previous study from our research group. It's not too polluted of a neighborhood. There's some spatial variability in these emissions. There's some transportation corridors that are contributing here to these mobile source emissions, but it's not terrible air quality. It's pretty moderate. And then physical activity, I don't have time to go into the details here, but I used a national survey data, the National Household Travel Survey from 2009, to model or predict active transportation time on a weekly basis based on individual and built environment characteristics, largely the reported commute mode to work. So here's what these look like in the study area. So the CDC recommendation for minimum levels of physical activity on the very left, if you take like the minimum value is 7.5 met hours per week, and a met hour is a metabolic equivalent unit, so it's a measure of intensity. Walking, for example, is 3.5 mets, so if you walk for 1 hour, then that's a 3.5 met hours of activity. So we can see that the CDC recommendation is 7.5, and the population for the neighborhood, we have fairly low transportation physical activity levels. It's especially low for individuals not in the labor force and individuals who drive to work. But if you start looking at transit and walking and then finally cyclists, the physical activity levels get much higher, and cyclists far exceed the recommendations based on our predictions. So you can see these sort of deficits. So I don't know what happened. It says value. Anyway, so you can see that for all groups aside from cyclists, there's some deficit relative to the CDC recommended physical activity levels in the case study neighborhood. And then finally, for crash risk, this is a little bit more difficult from sort of an epidemiological perspective, in that there's not, you know, large cohort studies looking at crash risk as or crash exposure as an avenue to a fatality. So there's a few studies that conceptualize crash risk using walking and biking trips per week as exposure, and then as well as vehicle miles traveled per year as an exposure. So that's what these levels are. We see on the left, this comes from the same regression modeling. If you walk to work, we predict you'll have about 11 walk trips per week on average. There's a much stronger relationship if you bike to work. You're really a biker, is what the data sort of says. And then we use some similar regression approaches for vehicle miles traveled, and a similar story. If you drive to work, you have a substantially higher annual average vehicle miles traveled than individuals who use other modes to commute to work. And then finally, the sort of thing that pieces all this together is this relative risk information, which for the transportation folks out there, relative risks are a way to sort of translate exposure metrics into increased risk for your health outcome of interest. So here we're using large meta-analyses of large cohort studies for fine particulate matter and physical activity, which are really sort of the gold standard of the epidemiological literature. And then, as I mentioned before, it's a little bit harder to think about crash risk. It's just not as often conceptualized in this way in the literature, but there are a number of studies out there that do that. So it's hard to think about model validation in this sort of perspective, where it means this really sort of conceptually abstract health model to think about populations over time. So what we ended up doing was thinking about this sort of thought experiment of if we had a example cohort that sort of was born in year 2013 and then aged 100 years in the same year. So we're exposed to the same exposures over that time period. We should see the same health outcomes in that population as we see in the general population. So here's an example of this cohort going between these states. So you can see the green line there is the healthy state, and that was on the far left of that first diagram. And then various disease states sort of start to become more prevalent by about age 35. And then finally the red is the mortality transition. And then we could look more closely at these two of these disease states, diabetes and cardiovascular disease prevalence, which we have survey data for. The survey data are those red lines from the behavioral risk factor surveillance system, and the black line is our modeled prevalence in our cohort. So this is sort of seeing if we're at least internally valid with our modeling technique. And we do a pretty good job until about age 70, in which case we're under modeling prevalence a little bit. So it's an issue we're thinking about and trying to address. We have a similar story here with cardiovascular disease prevalence. So overall, model validation is a difficult concept for these types of things, but we think that this offers a good enough depiction that we're, you know, internally valid, I guess I would say. So now the result, the health and modeled health impacts. First particulate matter, these are cumulative attributable mortality in our neighborhood over 25 years for the model. So we see initially a rate of about 1.8 deaths per year attributed to particulate matter exposure in the neighborhood, but that rate per year actually sort of tails off a little bit over time, partially because of the age structure of the population, but also partially because we're changing the baseline prevalence of disease, which actually reduces the yearly effect of an exposure. It's an advantage of a dynamic modeling approach. So those particulate matter concentrations are in our next risk here is crashes. So we see these are really pretty comparable risks, slightly higher for particulate matter. And then finally, physical inactivity, which is very much in line with sort of the crash risk. So looking at these risks in a more direct comparison, we can look at the percentage of the total mortality we estimate from those three risks over time. And we see consistently particulate matter slightly higher, and then crashes and physical inactivity are really fairly similar risks. So this is thinking about the population level. And then we can also think about these at the subpopulation level. So here we have attributable mortality by risk. I think this is for year 20 of the simulation. I forgot to put that on here. But this is broken up by commuting behaviors. So we see the largest health risks from transportation for drivers, individuals who drive to work, individuals who take transit to work have a much lower health risks from physical activity and crashes, and a net health risk is that's lower. The same story sort of with walkers. And then bikers, as we saw with the physical activity levels, we have a huge health benefit from physical activity for bikers. So the net there's actually net health benefits for bikers. So you can sort of interpret this as if you were in the neighborhood and you switched your behavior from driving to walking, you would likely see health benefits on an individual level. So that's sort of going back to thinking about subpopulations. And one interesting thing to note here, I mentioned earlier that there's a lot of individuals from 18 to 35 in our population. There's actually a college that's in the case study neighborhood. And so if we look at the walking subgroup, it's interesting that the health impact for particulate matter is lower, but not because exposure is lower. It's actually because the walkers are more likely to be college students, and that sort of health model, because it's age specific, calculates a smaller change in mortality risk at younger ages when you're exposed, just because baseline risk is lower. So we see this, we actually see that come out in the model. It's an interesting point to make. When I first saw this result, I sort of was scratching my head and had to go back and look at the relationship between exposure and behaviors in the population. So just going back to the objectives, so the novel dynamic model was a Markov chain approach. And then we applied here at a case study neighborhood, sort of a small spatial scale, both at population level as well as for subpopulations. And what we can draw from this is, I think the big takeaway here is that the magnitude of these three risks are really pretty comparable. And that's important in that in sort of the transportation decision-making world, oftentimes crash risk really guides a lot of decisions. And it may be the case that interventions that reduce crash risks might in the long term promote land use strategies that may reduce physical activity levels through increased car dependency, like a cyclical thing between land use and transportation. So it's an interesting argument for thinking about physical activity and particulate matter in a little bit more nuanced way in making transportation decisions. And then thinking about the population level, we do see that this similar conclusion that in this neighborhood, subpopulations that are active have reduced health impacts or health benefits in the case of bikers. And the next step for this project is some model refinements. Then we're going up to the regional scale and applying the same model across all neighborhoods in the region, which helps us answer this original question, which is somewhat of a disappointing end to the presentation in that there's still a lot more work to be done. But we think that we have done a good job with this modeling approach and look forward to seeing how these risks now vary across different built environment types and helping to understand that relationship a little bit more. So I'll take questions also afterwards, and if you have any more specific questions, feel free to jot down my email address and shoot me questions about anything related to this work. Thank you.